You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. The Second City is excited to work with Amazon as part of their new and exciting app called AMP. AMP is a home where anyone can create live radio-style shows alongside some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry, including ours. Join the Second City live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time for our show, Second City Public Radio. SCPR is an interactive weekly lampoon of all things public radio. Each week, our host and an ever-expanding panel of Second City characters open up the lines to listeners from around the U.S. to ask questions and offer us opinions on a slew of wide-reaching subjects. Download the app and don't forget to tune in, AMP, Thursdays at 5 p.m. Central Time. This is a really interesting podcast, I think. I think you will, too. Anu Radha-Dayal-Gulati is an energy practitioner and transformational coach who also has a PhD in economics. And after 15 years in finance and academia, she began a new path of helping people release the past and reclaim their power. And she has a new book called Heal Your Ancestral Roots, Release the Family Patterns That Hold You Back. We had her husband, Ranjay Gulati, on the podcast to talk about purpose. He's a Harvard professor. And Anu is just the best. And I think you'll find this really interesting. Enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock.
Anu, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It's my pleasure to be here.
All right. I have a somewhat long first question, so bear with me on this. Because I have to tell you, I cracked open this book around the holidays, which is the time of year for many of us when family myths, traumas, traditions, and stories are sort of revisited, they're reassessed, they're re-explored. And frankly, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Add to that, my particular world right now, at least, toggles between science and art. And there's a very specific tension in the book between your life as an academic and your shift into family energy fields and flower essences, which I didn't really know a ton about. And ultimately, one of the big things that I came away with from reading the book is that to navigate this human endeavor, just to say writ large, human endeavor, indeed to flourish in it, it's wholly necessary to sit inside that kind of tension and hear what it's telling you. Am I nearing the right path here in that assessment?
Yes, absolutely. That is the tension that we're struggling with, what we came from and who we want to be. And I think this tension, you know, in Eastern societies, this tension can sometimes be suffocating because you have to conform. And I feel like in America, and maybe as an outsider, this is how I see it. There's so much value placed on independence.
Right.
But that independence can lead to anxiety and depression, loneliness. So there is this tension that, you know, we're constantly navigating from birth between conforming and our own individuality. And that's the tightrope we have to walk. And we can do it.
Yeah, it's hard. And the polarity you're talking about is interesting because I actually hadn't thought about that in both cases, the cultural myths of our ancestral stories are wildly helpful in some regards in terms of giving us potentially a North Star to go by. But at the same time, there's this other side of it, which then, and I had the same thing reading this book where I'm like, she's going to talk about astrology. I'm going to have a hard time with this. And then you get into the astrology and it's like, oh no, this is, I don't have that same sort of gut reaction in talking about sort of indigenous medicine, like, which I'm like, I'm interested in. And I'm like, oh yeah, no, we disregarded that. And that doesn't make sense in this story. So, but it is sort of like you have to fight your own response. And I guess I didn't imagine that in the East, that's the same sort of same thing is happening, but in a different regard.
Yes. Yes.
So,
I mean, astrologers are like the dispensers of hope, you know, that's what their function is really. To dispense hope.
Okay. So there's in your introduction, you sort of introduced this idea that you've kind of talked about already. And I'm going to quote from the book, quote, "What if these patterns of events, experiences, and emotions that repeat in your life and relationships are indicating that something in your life needs healing? What if the source of these patterns is your family, but not as you know it?" And I think I know what you mean by that, but I sort of want you to expound on that. And then I'm going to sort of add in what I took from it when I was reading the book.
So let me just begin by outlining the idea of ancestral roots.
Yep.
And in Native American traditions, as well as many Eastern traditions, our ancestors are not just our parents and grandparents. They include those who came before us up to 7 generations before. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, if you think about it, it's like 254 mothers and fathers that need to have existed in order for us to be here today. And so if those are our ancestral roots, why are they important? And in many of these traditions, we have this idea that when you don't honor your ancestors, then they hold you captive. You repeat the fate of your ancestors. They act as a ceiling on your life. So why would that be the case? It's because when you think of the ancestral lineage, there is something unresolved in that lineage. And so as descendants, you know, we take on pieces of what is unresolved. And we take on the responsibility of healing that. Because when we heal it, we heal ourselves, we heal what came before us. And, you know, don't forget, our actions on this earth plane affect 7 generations to come. So we are influencing by our actions 7 generations to come. And you might say, you know what, I don't know my ancestors, I'm not connected to them. But the patterns, when they repeat from one generation to the next, it's not just theoretical. When I look deeply, I am stunned each time to see the patterns. I know now I'm trained to look at them and look for them, but they still amaze me that this exists. And I have to share one thing, Kelly. You know, there is a saying that says, you know, there is a U-shaped hole in the universe, a Y-O-U-shaped hole in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come to heal what is unresolved, you fulfill your destiny because you were born to fill that U-shaped hole and only you can do it. But if you never heal that ancestral story, you never fill that hole. It remains unfilled.
All right. So I have an awesome therapist and we were talking about this stuff because I'm the youngest of 6 boys, grew up in Kenilworth. You lived in Wilmette for a time. And my family is very well known in part because my dad was on WGN radio and TV for 33 years. And my dad was sort of famously kind and wise. And my mom was sort of like everyone's mom. And it was like our house was the place to cut. We were known as the House of Munchies. It was a place to come over and get fed. And like, And the story that I knew that start in as an adult now I'm exploring is the fact that both my parents came from terrible childhoods. My dad ran away from home when he was 16. I didn't meet my grandma till I was 16 on that side. My mom's dad was murdered, and that she was an only child, and there wasn't anyone from that side that I don't know anything beyond like a little bit of my grandma on that side and whatever. And so my therapist was literally talking to me about an ancestral trauma map, you know, in terms of have you looked back? And I'm like, well, I haven't. My brother has. He sent me something, and other things got in the way, so I haven't, you know, gone down that path. That was the thing that as I was reading this book, I'm like, oh, I have painted a very particular picture of what where I stand in this story that is one of sort of resilience, and but it also it's shut down. It's unexplored in terms of going farther back in that time. And so this was really maybe a wake up call, a bit of like, oh, that might be, if I'm feeling unfulfilled in certain ways or want to fully heal in certain ways, that's territory that I need to uncover and cover.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, when you say shut down, I mean, I'm curious, are you meaning like you just shut down that part of the history and exploring it? Or are you talking about parts of yourself that perhaps you shut down?
Second part, I don't know, but I'm willing to explore anything there. No, it was basically, you know, the family story stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. there wasn't an exploration. There were not cousins to talk to or know who came before, who was the great, great parent. And again, my brother has done some sort of research on that. Only, you know, six kids. He's the only one who was like expressed a certain kind of interest. And so it just wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
And then to me, it started looking at going, well, maybe it was unavailable for a reason, you know, and that bears some looking at, because, you know, the one thing as I've gotten older and experienced my own traumas is sort of recognizing that you're going to have both. And the one thing I've also recognized through this particular journey, both at Second City and my personal journey, is everyone is going through a lot of hard stuff that they don't talk about. And when I was going through my hard stuff and I chose to talk about it, it was very healing for me and for others.
Mm, wow.
Because it provided a context for them to be like, hey, I don't want to trauma compare. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, don't worry about it. What's going on? And then they realize like they're struggling with real stuff. And that silence that lay on the other side of that is maybe the worst thing that one can do if they're looking to heal.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And I think we all want to carry this this facade of I got it together. And it's only when we open up that, you know, we can see that we actually have a shared humanity among us. I just want to talk about your father first, because, yeah, you know, you used a word about your father.
Yeah.
You said he was very kind.
Mm-hmm.
All healing happens at the level of the heart. Mm. So his heart being open, you know, his heart being kind, doing things for others, whatever he carried from, you know, running away from home, that already shifts the trajectory of those to come. And so you may or may not feel like the burden of legacy from that side. He ran away at 16. You met your grandmother at 16. You know, there are these numbers are not necessarily coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
But when he does his healing work, as your father sounds like he must have, you get the benefit of that.
Interesting.
And in the case of your mother, if, you know, like you said, she was a typical mom of that time. But if you notice things about her that probably came out of what she didn't want to process, or maybe she buried in order to function, and if you feel that's affecting your life, then exploring that, you know, becomes worth doing. And, you know, I think for so many people, we might just know maybe our parents, our grandparents, but not much more than that. I barely knew my grandparents. I never met my grandfathers. So it doesn't really go that far back, but it's amazing how information comes. And for people in the US, I feel like they have so much access to, you know, the databases like ancestry.com, yeah, and, you know, things like that, which if I put in something, I'm not going to find anything here in this database, being an immigrant, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. All right, that adds another layer. Yeah, because I think For myself and my brothers, when we talk about this stuff, it's amazing how much wasn't spoken. And I remember too, for my wife and my son, who were very close with my dad, my son actually interviewed him, and sort of class project or whatever, but was like learning, like he'd come home and they'd like, talk about the stuff. I'm like, I had no idea. Like you just picked up stuff that I had no idea. And what the wrinkle that you're adding, which is very interesting to me, is perhaps that's not necessarily a block so much as, you know, whatever way that he found his way through this. And in turn, I think what I believe, and I think you sort of talk about this in the book a little bit, you get what you put out, you know, into the world. And certainly for my dad, that was the thing, is like, if he was, as he was, generally kind to people and generous and gracious and all those things, that sort of came in turn. And I certainly feel in my privilege in my life that I was the benefit. I benefited from that, and also modeled, right? So you hopefully, if you have good models, you use those sort of as you go forward. So, and it's not that there's not stuff, and your book is full of this in terms of these sort of discoveries, that whether it's your family or other stories that you heard of people discovering things that went on the past that have seemingly nothing to do with them. However, there was still some thing that needed to be addressed or atoned for.
Yes, something that remains unresolved. Because actually, when the transgenerational pattern shows up, it's really the energy of unresolved emotions that are making their way down. You know, and I mean, if I could share an example of a client.
Yeah, please.
And so this young girl came to me and she had dropped out of second year of law school. Mm-hmm. And her parents were really upset. She was getting upset. They were like telling her like she's crazy to do this. And so she came to me because she was just feeling like a victim of everything that was going on around her. And when we talked, it turned out that her mother had gotten pregnant while in college and dropped out and had, you know, several more kids. And so now her mother is seeing her drop out and it's like, I don't want you to do this. And there's got to be a boy involved. There's a relationship. That's why you're doing it. And she's like, no, this is not because of that relationship. This is not why I'm doing it. It turns out that her maternal grandmother dropped out of med school, got married, got divorced, then went back to med school and, you know, remarried. So this pattern of like men, education, something going on there, she was the third generation. So when I'm talking to her, I'm like, listen, you don't feel like you're a victim of what's happened, of your circumstances. This is a family wound. You know, try and like heal it. This is up to you to shift this pattern. And it existed. Just reclaim your power. And that's what we focused on. You know, what does she want to do? Can she do it by letting go of like this feeling of being a victim? And, you know, she started to get to this place. Like, what is the truth of who I am? What am I in alignment with? And I'm, you know, in her case, she actually decided to go back to college and finish her law degree. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's recognizing that the pattern is there, but that's why it might have showed up, but I don't have to take it on.
Can we talk a little bit about how you found yourself in Wilmette and Evanston and the sort of North Shore of Chicago? So your husband was at Northwestern?
My husband was at Northwestern. And I was, you know, I was in Washington, D.C. because I was working there. We were commuting back and forth, which was a little unusual for us. And then my son was born and my husband got tenure. And I came to this point where I wasn't able to like keep it all together. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe he would move, but he just got tenure. So it was like, I was like, okay, I'm done. My mother had a very strong message, which is mothering comes first, comes second, you know, and that's the messaging we pick up, right?
Right. At
whatever culturally we are imprinted with. And so that's why I moved from Washington, D.C. to Chicago. I was unhappy for a long time.
Yeah. Well, but it feels like the unhappiness opened a door, which then was sort of discovering this shop in, was that Main Street or Dempster?
Yes, Main Street.
So talk about that a bit.
You know, I think at some point this was all going to happen. It was meant to happen. Mm-hmm. I was going to, you know, sort of change course, change trajectory. But when it happened in a very, very traumatic way.
Mm.
Because I had a health problem. And I had to go into the ER. And, you know, of course, I thought, I'm going to come out. I'm going to pick up my life. I'm going to get on with it. And I'm going to be fine. But one night, out of nowhere, I had to be taken into the ER again for a second time. And I remember feeling really frightened and like, what's going on with me? Why am I not getting okay? And unbelievably, it happened a third time. And I remember the sense of despair, like sweeping over me. And I'm thinking, I'm never going to get well. And I could tell from the doctors that they didn't really know what was going on and if I was going to be okay. But I had this very dear friend, and she was into alternative healing. And yep. She came to see me. And when she held my hand, she said, you know, Anu, how many times are you going to go through this? What is it going to take you to change? And her words sort of ring in my ears, even today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I willed myself out of the hospital and I started to explore alternative methods of healing. Mm. And I found this amazing Chinese doctor and I discovered flower essences. And those two things together, they saved my health and they really changed my life. And I think what I realized most from that incident was that hope is such an important ingredient in our life. Hope is so valuable. And that's really kind of what led me to do what I do today, because I want people to recognize, to realize that you can change the trajectory of your life. You can create change. You can create a much more rewarding and fulfilling life. You are never powerless.
So I want to talk about flower essences because the only thing I know about them is what I've read in your book. But prior to that, our own experience when our daughter got sick was essential oils became a thing that sort of got recommended to us that I think in the past we would have been like, you know, whatever. But it became too serious. And the essential oils actually ended up becoming something that was very good for her in terms of her nausea. But that's not the same as flower essences. So can you tell us what the difference is and then what flower essences are?
So flower essences are different from essential oils because essential oils are, you know, steamed. It's through a steam distillation process. Yep. Through the leaves of plants. The flower essence is just the energetic healing property of the flower. So in ancient times, like dew was considered to have magical healing properties. But it was, you know, it's just challenging to get so much dew. And this British surgeon in the 1930s found a way of capturing the energy of the flower akin to dew. And through these wildflower infusions, he made them in spring water and preserved it with brandy. So unlike essential oils, these are taken internally.
Mm.
And when you think of the emotions, you know, in the University of Glasgow, they sort of said there are four primary emotions, fear, anger, sadness, and joy.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those has nuances. So fear, like there's several types of fear. So the flower essences work specifically with, you know, targeting the specific nuance of the emotion. And in some sense, because they're so specific, I think they tend to do much better than essential oils. At least that's my opinion, mm-hmm. because they can create change, you know, in a fairly short period of time because they're so targeted. Or the energy of the emotion.
Yeah. That's interesting. And did you, like, when you first discovered flower essences, was there anything in your mind that was sort of skeptical? Or was that something like, I get it. I understand what this is. Were you ready to sort of receive this sort of wisdom?
You know, I think as an economist, I was not ready. And if I had told my colleagues I was doing flower essences, they would have thought, like, you know what, I'm really crazy.
Yeah.
I had to go into the ER three times to change my mind and open my mind, really, is what I would say.
Right.
And that's when I started to explore it. But I think what was really valuable is noticing that they shifted how I felt. I was really upset about the move. I felt angry. I was bitter. I was resentful. And those emotions started to shift. I started to, become calmer. I started to let go of the resentment. I started to let go of the anger. I started to be able to participate in my life as it was. It was a big shift. And I had been dabbling in it. Mm-hmm. But, at some point I just jumped in and I said, you know what? I want to learn about this.
I was remembering, and I went through my notes and they weren't in my notes, so I didn't bring it up. But when I interviewed your husband last year, he said a very similar thing that you say in this book, which he said something along the lines of, if you had told me 10 years ago, I'd be writing about purpose with regard to my business book, and he's now at Harvard, I would have said you were crazy. So it's very interesting that you sort of both, and his book is very evidence-based and, in educational tome and but it also is allowing for this idea of something bigger than just you and I and the data that's in front of us.
Yes, that's true. And I have to say, being in an academic environment, mm-hmm. It was really hard. I hid the flower essences for a long time. And my skeptics was my husband. He was like, I don't know. What is this? What are you doing? Like, why do you need to do this? Like, he really wanted me to be, like something that he understood.
Yeah. But it sounds like that ended up being a gift in terms of for both of you, right?
Yeah, I really think so. I really feel like it changed our life. It changed our family life. I mean, it's been a huge, I feel like my life is what it is because of the flower essences. They've had such a tremendous impact on my life. And you know what I want to say, actually, Kelly? Taking flower essences is drinking the nectar of possibility for your life. That's what it does. It gives you a chance to see possibility for your life, for yourself.
I love that. In the chapter where you talk about how to honor your ancestors, you talk about altars, but then you also bring up things like All Saints Day and All Souls Day and Day of the Dead. And so, again, initially, if I'm sort of thinking about, and I've always been intrigued by ritual, especially in my world, because in improvisation, there are so many sometimes unspoken or spoken rituals. So before any show where Second City Ensemble is performing, or if I'm co-leading a facilitation, the individuals all pat each other back and say, I got your back. That is just a thing that was done. It wasn't written down anywhere. It wasn't in any manual. It's just something we saw and then we do. And it's immensely powerful with regard to entering. And I remember my friend Allison Wood Brooks at Harvard, told my wife Ann and I, we were in some conference and we mentioned the fact that even though we do tons of public speaking, we get nervous. She goes, oh, you should just say out loud, I'm excited. I'm excited about this speech, as opposed to saying I'm nervous. And I'm like, okay. And we did. I'm like, that's good. Like, wow. And it is, it's this framing shift, and when we talk about these All Souls Days, these other sort of events, it's like, I find those tremendously important and culturally meaningful. But it's hard as an American living where I do to then realize, oh, maybe that would be good for us as well.
Yeah, I think these rituals are all over the world, yeah. And except North America, they're even in yes. South America.
Yeah.
And so there's, and I think one of the things is we can adapt. We don't have to do it the exact same way, because even the way I honor my ancestors, I just adapted the rituals. I couldn't do it the way it was done in India. And I just want to share this little incident about this woman who decided to do her version of All Souls Day. And she invites people who have lost someone And they just come and they inner circle, they go around the room and talk about who they have lost and how they just honor them. Because we don't really have an opportunity for people to talk about who they are grieving for, how this might be affecting them, how can they honor them. So these little rituals like allow you to honor those who've gone on, allow you to make space for your grief, for your gratitude, and let that be there, present in your life. And I love how you have those rituals in Second City, because the ritual just elevates the ordinary into something, you know, sacred and meaningful and profound, and it shifts the energy, like you said.
Yeah, and the other way, what I realized, and I don't think my wife already knew we were doing it, we lost our daughter to cancer 3 years ago, and what we ended up doing, so for Christmas was, you know, always a time that was amazing for us, and, you know, both of my kids went to Waldorf education, so they made, you know, trinkets, and they made, especially there was lanterns, these sort of dimpled lanterns. And we decided to sort of take her lantern out and put a, you know, artificial candle in it. And that was something we sort of let lit throughout the holiday period, and actually ended up being something I was like, oh, that's there. And I see it every morning when I wake up and when I go to bed, and was something. And then, you know, the school ended up naming a park after her and building this incredible park that literally is on my drive to my therapist's office every week. And as I'm sort of piecing together, and we talked, I just talked about this the other day with Dan Pink and Kim Scott on this thing that we did, which is people wonder how you make it through these things. And it's like, you do the things you need to do to make it through. And one of those has been for ourselves is, what rituals can we incorporate, whether it's an event, whether it's a big event, like a holiday, but even like Tuesday, you know, these are the things that end up sort of one either falls into or does. And then, you know, by reading the book, it's also like, oh, this emanates from a place. It's not just a thing we can't necessarily came up with.
Yes. And I'm really sorry to hear that, Kelly. Mm. And I think this is the way we keep the flame in our hearts alive, by making space for that in whatever the ritual form it is. And that's important, because it's this veil that, you know, it's this veil that we are trying to cross. And the ritual allows us to part through the veil at some level sometimes.
And we don't talk about grief. This culture, and I know other cultures are better about this, our culture, and because my wife and I are very sort of public figures, and we wrote about this and talk about it, get hired by places to come talk about these things. And it amazes me afterwards where the line to come talk to me, and everyone is sharing their trauma, their grief. You know, I remember I gave a talk not so long ago, and a woman came up and she says, it's been 45 years. I think about her every day. And all I can tell you is, like swimming in the ocean, sometimes it's very calm and sometimes there's a tsunami and you can't tell when either is happening, but you know, you're going to be able to get back to the calm at some point. And then she walked away, and I was just like, this bombshell. But it was amazing. And it was just this, and I take it with me today. I remember that moment. I can picture everything, at her and all of that. But that such an American or North American thing is to not share. And this is the stoicism, and gritting your teeth. And it's like, that's some work. That doesn't work for me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, underlying this is the underpinning that, you know, we're sort of rational beings who have emotions.
Which, you know, as economist is not true.
Yeah. Oh, and because what if we flipped it? Yeah. What if we flipped it that we are actually fundamentally emotional beings who rationalize? Then we can make space for our emotions, because then they are taking center stage and we can follow them to that invitation to, you know, go inwards and take care of ourselves.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before I do that, I kind of want to get you talk a little bit about in the book about taking responsibility for yourself and releasing victimhood. And I feel like, and I recognize that we live in a time where a lot of people are struggling for a lot of different reasons. But this idea that I feel like we're all wallowing in competitive victimhood at times. And it's like, look, we're all like everyone's got crap. Everyone's got that. And so I wonder if this is a unique time for that issue to be at play, or whether you just see this as part of the human condition and the cycle that, you know, everyone goes through, all humanity goes through, this idea of sort of feeling the victim.
I think, you know, it's so easy to fall into victimhood. And even if we, you know, I see that sometimes I'm like, I'm not a victim of this anymore, but then I might feel a victim of something else. So the feeling of being a victim, you just have to recognize that it can like raise its head at any time. And the antidote to that, of course, is gratitude, because gratitude releases the feeling of victimhood. And I think this is why there's so much talk about gratitude. And so it's easy to slip into that feeling of victimhood. But I find, you know, and I'm going to just throw this out maybe for listeners, that one of the most powerful essences to shift the feeling of bitterness is willow. Willow shifts bitterness, and it's a wonderful essence to take on an ongoing basis, because the more you can see gratitude, the more you can actually start to notice the little things that make your life, you know, magical. They make your life wonderful. They make, allow you to open your heart to other people. They allow you to see your purpose, your, what are you here for? So shifting from victimhood is not easy, but once you start to get into the habit, it's like a muscle that grows stronger.
And that's tied to as well, right, to the story we're sort of telling ourselves of whatever happened to our family, happened to ourselves, or how we live in, because we know we're storytelling machines as human beings. That is always where story is more important than facts, which is a struggle in this country in certain ways, but is a truth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Because, you know, this, if we rewrite the story we're telling ourselves, then we can arrive at another place.
And is the flower essence a part of rewriting? It's probably not the sole part, but a part of rewriting that story?
Yeah, flower, because you know, there's an African proverb that says, when you cut your chains, you free yourself. And when you cut your roots, you die. And what flower essences are doing is they're helping us cut the chains, because those chains are limiting beliefs, limiting ideas, fears, anxieties. And what the flower essences are doing is they're shifting those beliefs, those negative emotions. They're transforming them so you can start to cut the chains. You reconnect with yourself. It's like an internal guidance system. It's allowing you to tap into the essence of who you really are. That's what
without getting rid of the roots, because you can't. Right? I mean, they're going to be there no matter what. So
yeah, so you can't get rid of the roots. The only thing you can do is like accept it. It's like it's like the yes and, right? 254 chapters before me. What can I do about it? Nothing. I'm just like, it's yes and I'm on stage now. The curtain on those chapters is over.
There's a phrase we have in our work that we definitely use in certainly the caregiving space, but I think the grief space as well, which is you need to play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think victimhood is, you know, that I want this to be different. I want to either fix my parents or fix the past or have somebody say, like, apologize. But there's nobody who can do that. It's us.
All right. So you gave us a little bit of yes and. Do you have another yes and story that was in the back of your mind?
Well, this is a yes and story I had for you, Kelly. And, you know, about 10 years ago, My son was in high school and he was going off to college. So he started this youth group for community service. And, you know, I was the lucky one. They were meeting in my house and he and a friend were running it. But the other mother and I, just, you know, to maintain order and minimize chaos, we were helping in the background. We were facilitating a little bit. And then, of course, my son goes off to college and I'm left with all these kids. And I'm thinking, I don't want this group of kids anymore. I'm done. I paid my dues. I take this group somewhere else. Go. And my daughter, she came to me and she said, Mom, these kids came here when he was here. You need to do something. You need to keep this going. And I thought about it and I was like, I don't know. And I noticed then that, you know, these kids, they had the little next leadership laid out. They had like what they wanted to do. It was like they were building their future. Mm. And I thought to myself, and I said, you know, I want to maintain this integrity of this group. I want to support it. I want to keep it safe. I want to keep it apolitical. And having taught at business school, I was like, I've worked with older kids. I can offer something. I can do something here. So I said, yes, and we'll have this group meet here once a month. So they continued. And, you know, I started to teach them leadership. And one of the things I was wanting them to understand is it's not just important to show up, but how you show up is important.
Yeah.
And then it really struck me one day that how am I showing up? Am I showing up as this victim, like who has these kids coming into our house, like bombarding my house? And I was like, I need to show up with an open heart to create a safe, nurturing space and do my best to contribute. And at that moment, I realized like healing happens when you show up for yourself. Mm-hmm. Like when I show up for myself, then I can show up for somebody else. But I had to show up for myself first. And I feel like this was the big gift I got from maintaining this group and continuing to support it.
Because I think, honestly, it's harder to show up for yourself than it is for other folks.
It is.
I mean, we all know that person, you know, and I know I love and respect and honor the people who do that. And they do it for me all the time. Like they're just there and they show up and like, yeah, what are you doing for yourself?
Yeah, it's hard. It's another thing that we're not really socialized to do. And especially for moms, you know, not socialized to take care of yourself, to take care of your feelings. Because when we are talking about taking care of yourself, really, we're talking about taking care of our feelings, making space for them because they are talking to us, making that space to connect with ourselves.
I love that. The book is called Heal Your Ancestral Roots, Release the Family Patterns That Hold You Back. Anu Radha-Dayal Gulati, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Getting to Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
rest of your life from adulthood. No one survives.